This is Jim Inkster coming today on the show. We'll recap LSU's 35-21 victory over Auburn Saturday at Tiger Stadium. Tigers now 4-0 as LSU heads to Georgia. The Bulldogs from Athens have been installed as three-point favorites over Les Miles and crew, and we'll talk about it with Cody Worsham, the editor of Tiger Rag. Also, Steve Myers, the founder of Tiger Rag, a prominent attorney and former house manager for the Deke fraternity at LSU on issues regarding fraternities, and that particular one after last week's upsetting sign outside the house regarding Kent State. And we'll visit with Mike Dana of the Louisiana Farm Bureau Federation talking about his amazing recovery from esophageal cancer. All this, but now the news on 89.3. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our numbers are 297-5633 locally, and outside the area, please call 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. J.C. Kane producing today, and we begin the week with Steve Myers, the founder of Tiger Rag Magazine, three-time LSU graduate, and former house manager for the Deke fraternity, which has been in the news in the last few weeks. Last week, the fraternity apologized after displaying a sign outside the house which read, "Getting Massacre is Nothing New to Kent State," a reference to the 1970 campus shooting in which the Ohio National Guard opened fire on 2,000 student protesters. Four people were killed and nine were wounded. Steve Myers, does this settle this issue?
I don't think there was an issue, actually, to start with. I have a favorite quote. It's, "The question that often drives me hazy, is it I or the others who are crazy?" Now, Albert Einstein made that quote, and there's no comparison, but if it applied to him, it can apply to the rest of us. In this particular case, my question is, what is the news about Deeks being Deeks? And part two is, does the First Amendment simply not apply to Deke? Notice in nothing that I said was there an apology apologizing for poor taste, because I don't think anybody disputes the fact that the sign was in poor taste and probably shouldn't have been put up there. But I'm not sure what the news item is that would justify it being on the front page of the Advocate.
Well, it was all over the world. In fact, I'm even reading a story from The Guardian about this. Mm-hmm. So it generated mm-hmm. much attention, and mm-hmm. So far, to my knowledge, there haven't been any sanctions, but why, if it's a First Amendment issue and the Deke people can do whatever they want, why did they apologize?
Well, I think because they're good kids, and I think that they realize that in this day and age of political correctness that you have to be careful about stepping on people's toes. Perception has a lot to do with it. But I guess the question I would simply ask to the people is first of all, the people who made this an issue are the news media. I mean, the people who would have seen the sign and the banner hanging at the Deke House, if you remember, I think you might have been in school at the time of the streaking incident back in the 70s, where everybody was walking around naked on campus. At least that's the story now.
And my time. Were you naked?
No, I was not. There was nothing to see, Jim. Although that was a funny story. One of the girls that was dating one of the Deeks, everybody had bags like the Saints used to wear, and yet one of the girls said, Jim, I can't believe that's you.
297-5633. Well, we'll get into the wild Deke history, and this kind of thing is not really new to the Deke guys, who are located right next to the Catholic Student Center. At LSU, and the fraternity has been around. How long has it been around, Steve?
Oh, gosh. It's, after the War of Northern Aggression, but the Civil War, I mean, the Deke fraternity itself at LSU, 1923, mm-hmm. the Friars Club. Mm-hmm. But, I think, again, the point to be made is that the formal officials of the fraternity, clearly, look, the Spencer Crane, the president, I think, of the chapter, without any prompting, when he realized that they had stepped over the line, they issued an apology banner, mm-hmm. apology sign the next day. And that was without any prompting from anybody on the outside. They were trying to make a joke and be funny, and it's an era that was well before any of these people remember. You know, whether it's ironic or coincidental, I was reading a book over the weekend by Sam King, the sports writer of the Baton Rouge paper, and there was a line in there, and it was a joke that my old boss used to use. And the joke was, other than that, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln? Now, if you apply the same standard, Acadian House Publishing Company and Sam King, well, that's quite offensive to the descendants of Lincoln and probably anyone else who's been shot in gun violence and so forth.
All right. Well, context is important, and some might say that that's equal to the Deke actions, and some would say it's not. And of course, Sam wrote it in a book, which is a bit different than putting it outside a house where the whole world can see. And by the way, I drove by the Deke house before the game against Auburn, LSU victorious, by the way, 35-21. I didn't see any signs this past week.
I think they had a self-imposed penalty. They brought up the number 33 on the team, the fellow that was the young man.
Jeremy Hill?
Yeah, that had some legal allegations that was allowed to play that apparently shook up a lot of people. But, you know, he got, a quarter suspension, so I thought maybe they might put a banner up at the end of the first quarter.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to be brief in your responses, but you've fired up the troops here, and we'll take some calls for Steve Myers, who is passionate in his defense of the Deke experience. You were there 4 years. You lived in the house?
Yes, uh-huh.
All 4 years?
Well, not the pledge year. I might as well have been there, lived there, okay. Because it was so much time. But, yeah, for 3 years after that.
All right, Joshua at LSU. Joshua, good morning. You're on the air with Mr. Myers.
It kind of touched on what I was wanting to say is until I read in the story and was reminded of Kent State Massacre, I was wondering what the heck everybody was making up about. You know, and I'm 36 myself, and all the students here are a whole lot younger, so if I didn't remember offhand, I'm sure it seems to me it's mostly just people who actually remember just kind of making a big deal.
All right, well, the massacre was May 4th, 1970. That's over 43 years. But people who study history and who were alive then, like Steve and me and many in our audience, it was something that was not a proud moment in U.S. history. And the Deke fraternity has educated a lot of people about U.S. history. So in that respect, maybe they've done somewhat of a public service. Brent in Shenandoah. Brent, you're on with Steve Myers. Good morning.
You see me again? You can
take. Hold on, Brent. We'll see if you can get him to a better place, and we'll.
You know, there was a letter in the editor, letter to the editor in the Advocate, Jim, which actually is now owned by a Deke, John Georges. I think he probably overreacted to try to show he wasn't playing favorites, because again, whether this story deserved the type of coverage it got, and if it was such a terrible thing, why were they reprinting the sign? You know, they won't put the N-word in the newspaper, so if this was such an offensive sign, why did the Advocate print a photograph of something that was so offensive?
Well,
that's not logical.
I think if the Deke House put the N-word on a sign and it was outside the house, that would be in the newspaper.
I'll bet you it wouldn't.
I think it would be. But you might be right. Brent in Shenandoah. Brent, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you doing?
I'm fine.
When I first heard about the story, I felt sort of like your guest did, you know, First Amendment rights and all that stuff like that, until I got the paper and read they have done this numerous times. These kids are supposed to be going to college, and they print in the paper. They didn't understand how their action would have hurt people. They didn't feel like it was that insensitive. Aren't these supposed to be future CEOs and people running business and corporations? Shouldn't they have a little bit higher standard?
I think he's exactly right. I think that's right. And the question is, how do you get there? I think we forget that every generation has to be re-educated, re-indoctrinated, programmed, and reprogrammed. And the fact is that Deeks have been doing this for 60 or 70 years. That was the point that the man that wrote the letter, who was a Deeks, infuriated, said, can't they learn anything? Well, they've got to relearn it. This is not the same group that put a sign up in 1960 at the Cuban Missile Crisis or 1973 about the Arab oil embargo. Deeks has been making social commentary for years and years and years. So the answer is both. Yes, you're correct. Nobody denies that it was poor taste. They recognize that it was an era and it could come to haunt them. That's what college is all about. And I think that we're making big mistakes by making big deals out of little things when these kids that are under such pressure need to have outlets. And the fact of the matter is, you can just imagine them sitting around trying to be creative, trying to decide what can they do that's going to make a pithy, funny, social commentary. And instead of doing that, maybe they should have been out, I don't know. They're gonna have pressure release, so to speak, in some form or fashion.
Well,
and this seems a pretty harmless way to do it.
25 years ago, Steve, this same fraternity, your alma mater, which, by the way, has had numerous people who are wildly successful in business as members, including the former governor, Mike Foster. They got penalized in 1988 for killing an ostrich. Those kinds of things aren't just venting steam and you called it a release. There's some things that are beyond the pale, aren't they?
I agree that there's some things beyond the pale, and you learn from them. One of the things about fraternity life, too, is that, you know, an individual can commit an act and the entire group is held responsible for it. You know, the whole football team wasn't held responsible for what Jeremy Hill did. So there is a problem with a fraternity activity and determine what is a group activity and what is an individual. Clearly, this had, you know, I guess someone else in the fraternity could have come and ripped down the banner. This is all part of the learning experience. Again, no one's making excuses. They realize it was a lack of judgment. But, you know, the king and I are on the same page on this. You know, King Alexander, the president of the university, clearly issued a measured statement that recognized that the sign was offensive and that the message showed a lack of judgment in hanging it. But he also recognized that if the question is really simple, does the First Amendment apply to Deke? And the real question that we all should ask ourselves regarding the First Amendment is, where is the line drawn? We don't doubt that the law can draw a line. The question is, where is it, and who's going to determine it? Would you, Jim, a journalist, suggest prior restraint? Do you want a sign committee that approves or disapproves with the sign? And how about, would that committee approve or disapprove some of the stuff that goes in the newspaper or on your radio show?
Well, you're right. I think it's a First Amendment issue. People have the right generally to be jerks. And in this case, it's more of a case of what was done rather than whether these people should be punished for it. But obviously, there are legendary stories about the Deeks. Here's one that some might find funny, some might not. Santa was going to come in by helicopter at Cortana Mall several years ago to see a bunch of kids in the parking lot. The Deeks rented their own copter, flew over the mall 10 minutes before the real Santa, and dropped a Santa dummy out in front of hundreds. You're laughing, Steve.
This gets better every time.
Hundreds of horrified kids.
This gets better every time. The Santa Claus story, which I never ever saw, has gotten to the point where it's got a life of its own. The Black Hawk helicopters dropping a Santa.
Yeah, nothing about a Black Hawk helicopter, just a helicopter.
A helicopter. That is when did this happen?
It happened a few years ago. So according to this, here's another one. The Deeks supposedly wrapped the house mom in a mattress and threw her out of the second story window. Did that happen?
No, that's unbelievable. I think people watch Animal House and then they just decide that they're going to go ahead and apply these to the Deeks. Look, my first story for the Reveille was about the Deek Christmas tree. Now, that's a something in an age gone by, but the Deeks used to have a Christmas tree, and no animals were affected or killed, but they did used to.
Okay, we're about to go to a break, but we'll talk about this and some football as well, as LSU won by 2 touchdowns over Auburn back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. 877-217-5757. Former Tiger Rag publisher and founder Steve Myers in the house, along with the current editor, Cody Worsham, will be joining us in a moment. LSU victorious 35-21 over Auburn. There were no offensive signs Saturday as the Tigers beat the Tigers from Alabama and now prepare to go to Georgia as 3-point underdogs to the Bulldogs from Athens. Here's a question to Inkster Show at WRKF.org to Mr. Myers, who, by the way, has 3 degrees from LSU, including a law degree. The University of Alabama recently saw protests over the segregation of fraternities and sororities on its campuses. What is the state of segregation within the LSU Greek system?
I'm not sure about the LSU Greek system as a whole. I do know that the Deacs are one of the first fraternities to actually integrate. Calvin Hill
was at Yale, right, exactly.
Well, it takes time, Jim, and Calvin Hill was a Deke at Yale, one of the first fraternities to integrate, and Deke has had a lot. Deke's had more presidents than any fraternity. Gerald Ford, George Bush, I forget the other one.
I don't know, but
there's four of them, I think, now. But in any event, I think the point is simply that, you know, how do you draw the line in a way that allows creativity? And sometimes you step over the line. You know, you loaned me a book from Bill Maher, and, you know, I was offended almost from the beginning to the end reading Bill Maher's book. That guy is a jackass. But he offended everybody and everything, except for the fact that I have to admit that I chuckled along the way and was affected by some of the comments he made when he was condemning Christians and things that people... The comedy is very difficult, and when you get too close to the line, sometimes you step over. I think these boys recognize that they did, but again, that is something each generation has to learn. I think they've learned their lesson.
All right, 297-5633 is your number. Referencing the question from Jason, the black students at the University of Alabama have accepted offers to join traditionally white sororities after a week of protests about segregation among the campus's Greek organizations. Judy Bonner, the president of the university, says 11 black students, this is a statement that was made last Friday, and 3 students from other minority groups have received bids or invitations to join historically white sororities. 4 black students and 2 students from the minority backgrounds have accepted those invitations. She expects the numbers to rise as the academic year continues. So the University of Alabama out in front on this issue in the South, ahead of LSU. And Alabama is, of course, a state that banned interracial marriage until 2001. Cody Worsham is with us, who also went to Louisiana State University. Were you in a fraternity, Cody?
No, I wasn't.
You were not?
No fraternity.
Did anyone try to entice you to join?
No, well, I guess if the only fraternity I was in was a basketball team. I played basketball at Nicholls State for a couple of years, and that sort of interfered with any fraternity opportunities at LSU when I came back.
But you ended up at LSU.
I did.
Now, I know several athletes who have been members of fraternities, and they, you know, obviously in recent time, the athletic program at LSU has been integrated, but the fraternity system has not. We've had people say, look, this is a private club, they should be allowed to do what they want, but it's at a state university, and these buildings are on state property, Steve.
That's a wide open question. I mean, you're talking about a really wide open question, because, you know, the Black Student Union is not integrated. There's all kinds of issues on that topic. I don't even know how to approach it, other than the fact that there's a lot of schools that don't have discriminatory policies that might set their tuition at a certain rate that economically you look at different demographics that wouldn't necessarily be able to attend that school. And that was the way it was, you know, at the beginning of integration. But the problem is I'm not really prepared to discuss all of that stuff. But, I mean, sure, I've never seen any overt attempt. I think it's really more a case of birds of a feather flock together. And based on what you said this morning, I mean, why would these people want to be a Deke anyway?
Well, there are other fraternities that might be more suitable. Judge Liu asked the question, saying, Steve Myers, were you once denied admission to the NAACP?
Yes, I was, actually.
When did that happen?
Gosh, I would say probably in the 80s. That was the greatest decade. George Eames, who was the head of the NAACP.
My dear friend.
And a good man, and I have a lot more respect now for him than I did, you know, at the time that we were locking horns. But he told me I needed to be deprogrammed and reprogrammed to understand, you know, the whole integration issue. And I said, that's fine. And I thought being a member of the NAACP would might expose it. And he said he wasn't going to let me in until I was deprogrammed and reprogrammed, although he never gave me the program to follow. So I don't know what the answer to that is. I just think people like to make issues where issues don't exist.
Well, I think you brought up a larger point about whether this should constitute some kind of action, and the president of the university implied that there might be some kind of action. I don't think there has, but the First Amendment is the First Amendment, and it would seem that this is something that's merely offensive, not dangerous. It's not yelling fire in a crowded theater.
No, it's not, and like I said, there's a lot of misunderstandings a lot of times, too. I mean, like I said, going back 60 years, the Deeks have had social commentary on their signs. I was going to mention earlier that the first article I wrote for the Reveille when I went to journalism school was about the Deke Christmas tree. You know, people would decorate, and the Deeks put this scraggly-looking old dead tree that they pick up on the road in the front yard, and they basically helped the DPW because they picked up dead animals off the street and hung them on the tree. Well, that was offensive to some people, and no animals were hurt in that activity. But the reality is nobody actually understood that we were laughing at them on the inside, because that was a protest against the commercialization of Christmas. And my first article was a Reveille. It was about that Deke Christmas tree. Now, that might have been a better way to express it than that, but the reality is I think when you know the truth and you see all these people on the outside making these allegations and accusations, and they don't really get to know you as individuals and people, it's sort of is hypocritical. And, you know, I think that there's enough fault to go around. There's no question, including from the accusers.
All right. Here's a question from Melanie. Was the Deke House at LSU the inspiration for Animal House, the movie with John Belushi?
I've heard that, and I don't know of any official formal contact. I did talk to a young man who went to Princeton many years ago, and he said that the Deke reputation is basically the same everywhere. So that his belief was that it was the inspiration for that movie, even though I don't know if there was any formal. Look, there's been a lot of fraternities that have done a lot of things. That's not an excuse. It's just that the Deke somehow or another seem to, I think, have people's attention because they maybe are a little better at it.
Here's a note from David Brown. He says, I had dinner with someone involved in the LSU Greek system, and he said that several of the previously all-white fraternities and sororities are integrated. Now, there have been some that do have some black members, but for the most part, that is not the case. But it hasn't been a complete exclusion of minorities, just an almost complete exclusion. But that's a good point from Dave. Now, the story of the last few weeks that charged up the LSU fandom more so than this Deke story was the Sports Illustrated expose about Les Miles at Oklahoma State. Cody Worsham, are there any repercussions from that, or is this over and done with?
It's kind of disappeared. It seems like it's over and done with, and I think Sports Illustrated was hurt by the fact that Yahoo came out with a story the same week that was very well documented, that had some very good on-paper sources, as opposed to Sports Illustrated, which was a lot of hearsay and chatter. I think there was something there to what Sports Illustrated was saying. I don't think they were making up anything. I think these guys were probably telling the truth, but just the perception with comparing the two stories and the way that Yahoo was so documented with the text messages and the Western Union papers, and it was so different from the Sports Illustrated story, which was really based on a lot of guys that seemed to have fallen out with the program just talking.
Well, as long as Les Miles continues to win, and he is doing that in grand style now, 89-21 at LSU, I would imagine stories of this kind are just noise in the background. Not going to be any big deal unless there's some kind of revelation regarding his tenure at LSU. And to this point, there has not.
Yeah, I think that would be the key. It would have to be something that happened while he was at LSU, because Oklahoma State was such a long time ago. The NCAA statute of limitations is 4 years for these sorts of investigations, and he's been at LSU since 2005, so that's obviously passed. I think there would have to be some sort of story about improprieties happening at LSU, and that's assuming that those have happened. He may have cleaned it up, or it may have never happened at Oklahoma State. It's just a lot of speculation right now.
Now, Cody, you heard Mike Archer, the former coach at LSU, speak Saturday before the Auburn game at the Andone Museum, and he noted that now we have this 24-hour news cycle and a lot of websites devoted to LSU sports. He said that back in his day, he was head coach from 1987 to 1990, that there was only Tiger Rag. You only had to worry about Tiger Rag. But some would argue that there was more scrutiny then than now. I know press conferences were a lot livelier then than they are now. Rarely does Coach Miles get asked a pointed question in a press conference, does he?
Yeah, and he doesn't take it too well when he does get asked a pointed question. So it's definitely a different media landscape, and Steve can probably comment a little bit more on that because I obviously wasn't covering it back then. But I would think, just based on what I've read and observed, that it's probably a little bit easier these days.
Well, Steve, you were there in, 1978 to 1993 with Tiger Rag, and there were many pointed questions, and they were from people from The Advocate, the Picayune, from Tiger Rag, from radio and television. It was sometimes a free-for-all. We had some memorable press conferences.
Well, you also have to look, you mentioned earlier, look at the context. I mean, the 80s, from a reporter's standpoint, I mean, my gosh, you couldn't have asked for any more if controversy, if that's the word, or new interesting news is what you're looking for. It was off the field, unfortunately, but I mean, during that period of time, I think we had 5 football coaches and 4 athletic directors and 3 chancellors, and I mean, it was turmoil at LSU. So the subject matter was a little bit different. I mean, I'm sort of amused and ask myself sometimes, how would we have handled, you know, Les Miles today? I mean, there's only so many pointed questions that you can ask. I mean, the guy's made mistakes, obviously, but when you look at the record and you look at what's been done, frankly, I think...
What about Jeremy Hill? About, you know, let's face it, LSU's leading passer and leading rusher last year are both sex offenders.
That's true, Jim, but context is part of it as well. If you threw off everybody in the NFL that committed a crime, or the NBA, I think it would end the league. It's not that far from the truth. So I read somewhere 40 or 50% of the NBA had some sort of charges at one point. Here's the point. It's always been there. It hasn't been as widespread. If you'll remember, one of the great exchanges between coaches and reporters was in 1980 when Jerry Stovall issued a starting lineup and had Jesse Miles
81
yeah. Had Jesse Miles as the starting tailback, and then at the game it was announced that he had been suspended since the spring, and the entire postgame press conference was on this one little
and the entire
item.
Pregame press conference for the next game. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And
he lied.
And you know what the crime was? The charge was like shoplifting. And the reporters, it was almost comical, because it got to the point where it's 20 questions until one reporter finally asked, the item he sold, bigger than a bread box?
Okay. I think that was John Jones, who later became president of the Green Bay Packers. Here's a note from Brian Breen. He says, Mr. Meyer's attitude represents much that is regrettable in Baton Rouge culture and in our country in general. These frat boys learn no lessons, but instead go on in life to promote a culture of cruelty in business, church, and the rest of society. Your response, Steve Myers?
I mean, I have no response. People have that opinion.
Well, no response is appropriate. And I think Steve's a quality man. He just has some opinions that some would take exception to, including yours truly.
Well, and you know what? I'm kind of a Nick Saban guy in this sense that I would think you look at the process. If the process is right,
yeah,
then the results end up being what you look for. And I don't. And part of my anger, if you will, is not so much that the Deeks showed poor judgment. It's the idea that some people, like the one just now, expect that the government's going to step in and tell everyone how to run their lives, what they can say, what they can't say. I'm about the process and the First Amendment. I am not defending the sign any more than I would defend anything that someone else did that I thought was in poor taste. But I just turn my head and go on. You don't make this big issue out of something that happens every day in life.
Okay. Well, Cody Worsham, LSU is a 3-point underdog against Georgia. What do you think about the Saturday game at Athens?
You know, I think that's probably fair. I actually picked Georgia to win by 3 points, and I think the home field advantage is going to be critical. You also look at LSU's defense and the struggles that they've had, giving up 333 yards to Auburn in the second half alone. I think that's concerning, especially when you go play an offense as potent as Georgia's. Aaron Murray is the number four passer in the country in terms of efficiency. They've got a great running back in Todd Gurley. So with all those weapons, it's difficult to see the LSU defense slowing them down. The LSU offense is just going to have to play keep up.
Well, the Tigers of LSU looked good Saturday, but Auburn did move the ball against them.
They did. I wonder how much of it had to do with the weather in the first half with Auburn's offensive struggles. They had a punter that just dropped a snap that looked like it just slipped through his fingers. They had a really easy fumble on a quarterback exchange with a running back, and I think that really helped LSU out. I think it was actually a closer game than the score indicated, and obviously the fans emptied out at halftime, and LSU had to play the second half in front of about 45,000, and that probably didn't help in terms of a home field advantage, but I think LSU ultimately played well. The offense came around. Zach Mettenberger responded really well to an interception and went 9 of 11 for 160 yards and a touchdown after throwing an interception. So that's the kind of thing you like to see, in especially in an offense that looks like it can carry this team. It's just going to have to play, like I said earlier, keep up with a Georgia offense that's equally talented.
And Steve Myers, what do you think about half the stadium being empty, maybe more than half, when the game was still on the line?
That's interesting you say that, because I got the opposite impression. I was watching on TV, and I told the proprietor of Mestizo's, the restaurant where we were eating, I said, you're going to have a big influx in the second half because everybody feels they got this game under control. And that's kind of the way that I felt, that not that LSU is at the point where they're cocky yet, but I do kind of have that same feeling that I had entering the Alabama championship game, where people were measuring for rings, forgetting what actually happened. And I think they might be a little overconfident, frankly. And I think that if they're not prepared, I don't think they could just get beat. I think they could get beat badly by Georgia.
Well, LSU in the last four seasons is 38-6 under Leslie Edwin Miles. And I think Cody, he has to rank as one of the great coaches LSU has ever had, maybe the greatest, although Nick Saban might take exception to that. But part of his legacy will be affected by the outcome Saturday at Georgia.
It will. It's a big game. It's absolutely a season-defining game.
And Cody Worsham, editor of Tiger Rag, is picking Georgia by 3 points. We'll talk with the remarkable Mike Dana in 90 seconds. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Cody. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Mike Dana is with us. He is the public relations director for the Louisiana Farm Bureau, and he has quite a story that is unrelated to his success as a journalist for many years, but he is a cancer survivor, and it was a year ago tomorrow, September 24th, 2012, that Mike went under the knife as a result of being diagnosed with esophageal cancer. Good morning, Mike Dana.
Good morning, Jim Inkster. Has this microphone cooled off? Because this is where Myers was sitting.
Yeah, I think we're okay. But this is a much more sober topic, and it is a serious one. And you're an inspiration to a lot of people, including me. You beat the odds. How'd you do it?
Well, by the grace of God and a woman by the name of Renee LaCour is how I did it. As you said, about a year ago, I underwent surgery for stage 3 esophageal cancer. I had no symptoms leading up to the disease. Around the third week of April of 2012. I had a little difficulty swallowing my mother's lunch, which has never been a problem. And it's one of those things where you think, well, you know, who knows what that is? I'm 53 years old, and maybe it's just a little bit of this, a little bit of that, the aging process. And about a month later, the condition got progressively worse. And so around the middle of June, I went to my doctor for a regular checkup, kind of explained to him what the situation was. And the night before I went, I Googled difficulty swallowing. And the very first thing that popped up was esophageal cancer. And a Mayo Clinic study said that 75% of all patients were dead in the first 12 months. And I thought, that's just great. So I went to see my doctor the next day, Dr. Michael Rolfson at the Baton Rouge Clinic. And he said, how you doing, Mike? And I said, I'm fine, Mike. How are you? And he said, I'm well. And I said, you know, other than a little esophageal cancer, I'm doing okay today. And he said, what? Wait a minute, what? And I described the symptoms, and his disposition changed immediately. And he said, as soon as this checkup is over, you're going down the hall, and we're going to schedule an upper GI. And on June 20th, I was officially diagnosed with stage 3 esophageal cancer.
And you kind of knew it was coming, didn't you?
Well, you know, it's weird. We have colon cancer runs in my family, but it usually does not get the men in my family until their late 70s. Early 80s, and I joked with my doctor that I had to live long enough so that the, you know, colon cancer could get me. But I guess I was just too naive to realize just how serious this condition was. It strikes most men in their 50s. It is the most prevalent form of cancer that we see increasing in the country. And the problem with the cancer is that it literally provides no pre-diagnosis symptoms. By the time you have the symptom of difficulty swallowing, the cancer has probably progressed to stage 3 or further. And so, there was never a time that I didn't think I was going to beat it. And I've been truly blessed because the odds were definitely stacked against me.
Well, you're right. The major sign is difficulty swallowing. And Mike, other than that, had no indication on mid-April when you said you first noticed this, and then by June you're diagnosed, and by September you're undergoing a major surgery. And when I say major surgery, you got a complete redo inside, didn't you?
I joked with my surgeon that I got a gastric bypass, a facelift, and a tummy tuck all in one, because you know, we hear so much about artificial organs these days. There is no such thing. People asked me, did they put in the artificial esophagus? I said, no, they didn't. They took out the real one, and then they rolled my stomach up, sewed it to the top of my throat, and made me a new esophagus. And as a result, I lost about 50 pounds. Most patients lose between 15 and 20% of their body weight. I lost a third of my body weight. And there was a time when things looked pretty bad. I was actually, my girlfriend Renee LaCour's son is 16. Nick is 16. And he and I were sharing the same wardrobe for many, many months after my surgery. So,
well, you were always in good shape and very conscious of staying in good shape, and you didn't have a whole lot of weight to lose.
I did not. I think I weighed about 166 pounds at the time of my diagnosis. You know, I never smoked and I rarely drank, which is really kind of unusual that the disease struck me, because I had no lifestyle issues that would have led to this condition. But I found out my mother, who is 79 years old, was born in 1934 with something that was later to be determined as Barrett's esophagus, and that can be a precancerous condition. But in 1934, they told my grandmother to take my mother home, put a little whey powder in her milk, and that kind of improved the situation. And my mother went on with her life. And it was interesting because she never gave it a second thought, and we never knew it was there. And so, you know, most of the time, if you know there's a cancer there, you can kind of take precautions in your life because you know these things are coming. But I knew the colon cancer was there. And so, you know, I watched my weight. I didn't smoke. I try to watch my diet. And out of the blue, I get some rare form of cancer that nobody in our family knew even existed.
How big was the tumor?
The tumor was 4 centimeters, and I was very fortunate in the fact that it was at the base of my esophagus where it met my stomach. And amazingly, Jim, the tumor never grew, never moved. It never found its way into any of the lymph nodes. It was truly a miracle. And, you know, I'm right now kind of part of a a program at the Baton Rouge General looking at their technology and the doctors. You know, we hear about cancer research taking place in, you know, other parts of the country, so-called, you know, prestigious research hospitals and whatnot. I was very fortunate in the fact that the Baton Rouge General and the Pennington Cancer Center had just acquired a new piece of technology to administer radiation therapy called the Artiste. It is the only radiation administering device in the country today. It resides at the Baton Rouge General. It had been on site there for about a year after my diagnosis, and before my diagnosis, rather, and you will not convince me otherwise that faith, the doctors, and the technology saved me, because this piece of equipment did not exist 5 years ago.
Well, also, I think the fact that you went in early, too. As soon as you had a symptom, you were there. If you had waited another month or two, might not have had the same outcome.
The treatment was very aggressive. Dr. Militello, on June 20th, when the diagnosis was made officially, 2 days later I went in, had a metaport installed to begin the chemotherapy, and literally they removed the bandage over the metaport to begin the chemotherapy. They were not going to wait so much as an extra day, and it was very aggressive. And thank goodness that it was such an aggressive treatment option, because, you know, this was not a very survivable cancer.
How many radiation sessions?
It was 35 straight days of radiation and 2 weeks of chemotherapy. And I don't remember a lot about it. Over the weekend, Renee and I kind of celebrated the one-year anniversary, and we had set up a Caring Bridge website to kind of let folks know what was going on with me. And I did write during that process, and I really had to go back and read some of those things. Chemotherapy and radiation, as any cancer patient will tell you, it takes it out of you no matter how strong you are. And, you know, we were reading some of these things over the weekend, just looking back at some of the experiences. And it was amazing. And, you know, she blogged after my my surgery to kind of keep my friends and folks kind of updated on what was happening with me. And it's amazing. I had no idea that she had written all of these things. And they were very moving and very touching. And she saved me. She really did.
297-5633, 877-217-5757, or Inkstershow at WRKF.org. For Mike Dana, 1 year ago tomorrow, September 24th, 2012, he was going under the knife for esophageal cancer, particularly lethal kind of cancer. And a year later, he looks great, and he has come back full force, and the prognosis from here out is a good one. JC, can you steer me to where we're going here? This is Richard in Lafayette. Richard, good morning. You're on with Mike Dana.
Yeah, hi, Mike. I was listening to your story, and it could have been my brother talking, because he went through exactly the same thing you went through. He is one of the survivors, and he was diagnosed with it about 2 years ago, didn't think he was going to make the next Christmas, and today he's in about the same condition that you are and experienced everything you did. One of the things I wanted to mention is that in the book, Dr. Mary's Monkey, who was written by a guy who Jim interviewed a few weeks ago, is a fascinating book, and he lays out a pretty significant case as to why so many soft tissue cancers have been accelerating in the last few years. And I tend to go along with what he said in that book. It's very, very credible. But it is amazing that esophageal cancer has increased 400%. In the last 10 years. And that's all I had to say.
And that is true. You know, I think at the time, the last study was done by the Mayo Clinic said something along the fact that there were only about 17,000 cases of esophageal cancer in the United States. It's rampant in third world countries because of smoking, poor diet, and alcohol consumption. But, you know, I don't know. When you're given a cancer diagnosis, the first thing you try to do is, A, come to terms with the fact that you now have cancer and you've got to figure out a way to beat this thing. But the other thing is you start kind of assessing and reassessing your life, and you're thinking, okay, as a kid, did I eat too much of this? Or, you know, was there some lifestyle thing that I was doing that I just didn't realize? My father smoked until 1972. He quit when I was 12 years old. I lived in a house with a smoker. The first thing I did was I asked my doctor. I said, you know, could that have had anything to do with it? He said, no, the too many years have passed. And I thought, you know, I do eat a lot of red meat. You know, I work on behalf of farmers, so I practice what I preach. And I've really not changed my diet. But you really begin to look at all the things that we eat here in South Louisiana. You know, my mother is French. My father was Italian. So there was always either pasta or gumbo or some one of those menu items always in my household. And I thought, was you start looking at all these things, and the more I thought about it, I really came up empty-handed. And I just thought, no matter how healthy you are and how you live your life, you cannot overcome heredity. Period. You're born with it. It's imprinted, and off you go.
Well, you're an amazing story. You survived, and Mike is now kind of the spokesperson for Baton Rouge General's Cancer Center. Obviously, they did good work.
It was a phenomenal campaign. A dear friend of mine, Lisa Tramontana, who I worked with as a fellow reporter about 30 years ago when I worked for Gannett, is with the Baton Rouge General's PR department. She jokingly, she said, "Mike, you've got a great story to tell. Would you like to help us out with this campaign?" And I said, "Yes, I would." And she said, "That's great." She said, "Very, very few folks we feature on these commercials come with their own television studio." So I helped them out. But it's a phenomenal campaign. And I tell you, the Baton Rouge General and the Pennington Cancer Center here in Baton Rouge, we really do have some very, very gifted medical practitioners here in this city. And, I'm like everybody else. I was really never sick. I never went to a doctor on a regular basis. I didn't even have a family physician until about 10 years ago. But when you start really looking at the Baton Rouge medical community, we are truly fortunate in the fact that we have some good doctors and some good technology in this city.
Kristen, noting how good Mike looks as the host of This Week in Louisiana Agriculture.
Sure which Kristen you're referring to.
Says, you noted that you had a facelift too?
Well, Dr. DuPont, when they kind of came in with the initial incision under my jawline on the left side, when he went back in, he kind of tucked it in just a little bit, which helped this 53-year-old neckline of mine. And, fortunately, the camera does add 10 pounds because I went back on the air around the end of November, and Dr. Militello told me, he said, "The camera does add 10 pounds," because the next day he saw me and he said, "My God, you're skinny. I guess I just didn't realize how much weight you had lost." But, it's been an incredible ride. And hopefully I'm going to be around to hear you and Myers antagonize each other for years to come.
Well, it took a while for you to get your appetite back.
That's one of those things that kind of goes with the territory. I barely had enough stomach to make the new esophagus, and my new stomach ended up about the size of a tennis ball. And so I guess I've been blessed with the thing that everybody on the planet thinks about. Can I eat anything I want, whenever I want, in as much quantity as I want, and never gain a pound? And the answer to this is yes. I would not recommend the plan to anybody, but it works.
And for a long time, you were complaining about a ringing in your ear. Has that gone away?
No, it has not. Father Trey Nelson here in town had this procedure done about 11 years ago. He called me on the third day of my chemotherapy, and the first thing he said was, "How are you feeling?" And I said, "I'm not feeling too well." And he said, "Are your ears ringing?" And I said, "Yes, they are." He said, "Dr. Militello told me that I'm the only patient he's had who, after 11 years, the ringing has never gone away." And I still have it, but you know what? If that's as bad as it gets, ring on, baby, ring on.
Well, when they were wheeling you in early in the morning 1 year ago tomorrow, September 24, 2012, what were you thinking?
Well, I posted it on my Facebook page. At 5:35 a.m., I posted one word, showtime, because I knew that no matter how I felt about it, all these procedures and processes had to be done. And as you said, it was major surgery. But again, Jim, maybe I was just too naive to realize there was nothing in my mind that said I was not going to get up off that table, and within 10 days I was not going to be back at Renee's. And the Lord willing, that's exactly what happened.
It is a remarkable story. But when you came out, I'm sure you were thinking some things then too.
The first thing I asked Renee, as I can recall, in ICU was, she said, I whispered, "Am I alive?" And she said, "Yes, you are alive."
I think I saw you later that night, and you said
did.
You wanted some spaghetti.
Which is bizarre because, I didn't want to look at food the first few weeks after my surgery, but I had no choice.
Well, you've come back full force and really have inspired the rest of us. And I'm sure people, unfortunately, every day in this community get this kind of diagnosis.
I heard from a friend of mine over the weekend who told me that her husband of 20 years passed away on Saturday as a result of this very disease. And, I shed a tear, I said a prayer, and that's really all you can do because this disease is indiscriminate. And I don't know why I survived, and I don't know why others don't. I have become a much more spiritual person over the last year and a half or so. I see the big picture. I take a lot of things in stride, things that never used to, you know, things that I would always fixate mm-hmm. on don't even concern me anymore because I now have the greatest gift of all, and that is more time.
Well, we're glad you're spending some of it with us, and let's keep this going. Maybe next year another update from Mike Dana. And you're right, Mr. Myers stirred some people up. I want to read one email quickly from Carlos Thomas. He says, Jim, I served as the faculty advisor to the Deacs at LSU from 2000 to 2002. They were good kids, but they were desensitized to the implications of their messages. I was immediately called to the Dean of Students' office once to intervene after a particularly offensive sign. Speaking to the young men made little impression, and they reacted much like your guests today. But they were good kids, had myopic perspectives, and by the way, Carlos writes, I'm an African American. We thank you for listening, and we'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.